of understanding quantum field theory. Unless you had the fortune of learning quantum field theory from a condensed matter physicist, you probably spent the first year of your life as a quantum field theorist thinking about scattering amplitudes. The S matrix is so useful, not just because it's connected to experiment, but from a more theoretical standpoint, it's useful because it's a gauge invariant and field redefinition invariant object. And as a result, it allows us to study the theory without any of the clutter that comes with different conventions and different choices. At a rather mundane level, the S matrix allows a clean comparison of different people taking different approaches and has been very useful for the years for resolving controversies and hastening advancement. You could say that in cosmology, we don't have anything quite as strong as the S matrix and that it's sorely missed. Partly for experimental reasons, the traditional scattering experiments are not sort of deemed feasible, and therefore the emphasis is focused on different types of observables, namely CMB related objects. This has led at times to there being long-running, long-standing controversies in the literature over the interpretation of various quantum field theories, even in the extreme examples to ongoing fights between about the interpretation of linearized quantum field theories in the cosmological setting. More generally, when it comes to, say, perturbative quantum gravity, the kind of observables that are relevant for cosmology are really nowhere near sufficient to address some other issues we would like to study, such as the perturbative stability of the theory. And so for all these reasons, we would really like something like an S matrix in the cosmological setting. We would also like.
Okay, can I ask you?
Yeah.
For clarification, so you're saying that analyzing perturbative quantum gravity is not necessary for cosmological observations, or I'm not.
What I'm saying is that the kinds of objects one might wish to study that are related to the observations that you and I and our astronomical friends can do are not a sufficient set of observables or questions to answer things like the quantum stability of De Sitter space. One would also like to consider objects which are not a priori observable by
humans.
So
you're saying observable in principle or in practice?
I mean both, really. I mean observables in the sense of gauge invariant objects, but I also mean.
If it's not observable in principle, then is it them in physics?
That's a good question. If it's a meta observable, right? It's a good question. My simple statement is that questions about, say, observables tied to CMB tend to relate to questions that can be asked at a given time. And we would also like to ask questions about, if you like, the observer who lives in an eternal inflating cosmology and the things he has observed over his lifetime. And these are things that are often not emphasized in a CMB focus. Yeah?
I mean, you said that cosmological observers are not gauge invariant to all orders.
Yeah.
I mean, but wouldn't you be happy to say that up to certain order they are invariant? And then we don't care about what happens.
I'm not content with that because suppose that something terribly interesting happens in some observable I've cooked up that's invariant to fourth order in gravitational coupling. Well, what am I supposed to do to study that observable better? I can't compute it to the next order because it's no longer gauge invariant. So no, I'm actually not content with that. However, I should just say that
practically speaking, we won't be able to. I mean, if something is invariant to this order, from a practical point of view, computationally, it's often not feasible to do it to higher orders.
There exist non-perturbative gauge invariant observables in Yang-Mills theory that could not be computed given certain perturbative techniques. I mean, I disagree with that. However, so in cosmology, we have reference points. We have a surface of less scattering and other reasons why this is not such a crucial issue. I'm not trying to make a comment on a shortcoming of our understanding in cosmology. I'm simply stating that from a more mathematical perspective of analyzing quantum gravity, we would like to consider objects other than those things tied to the CMB. That's all. So in particular, I have in mind various applications to DSCFT and other possible theories of quantum gravity in the cosmological setting. DSCFT is sort of undergoing a resurgence and has much more substance to it than it did 10 years ago. In particular, there now exist a number of concrete microscopic DSCFT proposals. And the one thing they have in common is that they are propose a duality between quantum gravity in De Sitter space and a Euclidean CFT, which is not unitary. In particular, what I'm describing here is the Vasiliev DSCFT of Aninos, Hartmann, Strominger et al., as well as a number of very simple comments by Maldacena relating quantum gravity in De Sitter space to conformal gravity. So the common feature of these is that they involve the Euclidean CFT, which is not reflection positive. So it's not unitary in the usual sense. So the key question in these DSCFTs is, how is bulk unitarity encoded in the Euclidean CFT?
Okay. Can you say what they're not reflection positive?
That's right.
Positive under what reflection? Positive in what sense?
Under time reversal. Reflection positive is a technical term. It usually it means that if you would consider Euclidean states, they would not have positive definite norm. So it doesn't have, it's not the usual Hilbert space structure. Yeah, but reflection positive is an old phrase. It used to be an important thing in Euclidean CFTs because its analytic continuation to Lorentz signature is what yields positivity.
So is your perspective going to be maybe there's some secret way that these are not bad for the usual reasons, or I'm just going to do it, never mind?
There's no secret. The idea is that the Euclidean CFTs don't provide the boundary correlation functions like they do in anti-De Sitter. If they did that, then you would have a problem. You'd have non-unitary initial data.
Well, that's one issue.
It's
also worth pointing out that actually Euclidean non-unitary CFTs count in each of those type of modifications. So those are the middle
of the
module. Yeah. Okay, this is a longer.
So the health of these dualities is not so much the issue. The issue is that there at some point has to be some translation from a theory that's not unitary to a theory that is. Okay. So the point of this talk is that the S matrix can help make this translation. The S matrix is a unitary map from the Hilbert space to itself. It's an ideal tool for studying unitarity. So the idea is to use the S matrix to understand basic features, basic implications of bulk unitarity, and find that encoded in the dual description. Another reason to study the S matrix is that it gives us something to compute. So just a moment ago, Tomislav was asking about gauge invariant observables that could be invariant to all orders. This is one candidate. In Minkowski space, modulo issues with infrared divergences that occur from massless fields, the gravitational S matrix is a well-defined gauge invariant observable. Okay. The proposal here is that the S matrix could provide such an observable in De Sitter space. So the goal of this talk is mostly more modest. It's simply to introduce the S matrix for weakly coupled quantum field theories on a global De Sitter space that can be computed order by order in perturbation theory. It's fundamentally defined in perturbation theory. For massive fields, we can verify that the S matrix is unitary, De Sitter covariant or invariant. Invariant under perturbative field redefinitions, transforms appropriately under CPT, and reduces to the flat space S matrix. In fact, it could even be taken to define the flat space S matrix. Using this S matrix, we will display a non-trivial constraint of bulk unitarity, which manifests itself in the asymptotic behavior of correlation functions. This is something you can look for when attempting to propose a DSCFT duality in which the dual theory is non-Euclidean, is non-unitary. You'll need to satisfy this unitarity constraint. Really, most of the recent progress that I want to talk about in the latter half of this talk is work towards generalizing this S matrix to massless fields and Einstein-Hilbert gravity. So I'm always happy to answer questions, and you should definitely interrupt me. However, I didn't plan for this to be an overwhelmingly technical talk. So it can still go either way. But I don't have slides with details of iEpsilon prescriptions and things of that nature. OK, so the outline is quite simple. After reviewing some conventions and some basic definitions, we're going to spend some time doing old-fashioned polology, which is relating S matrix amplitudes to poles in a suitably defined complex mass plane. After that, I wanted to go through an example of tree-level scattering. That will pose a bit of a conundrum, which then we'll have to sort out in the next section, which deals with particle stability and the optical theorem, et cetera. And then I'll spend some time talking about future directions. OK, so this talk will take place in global De Sitter space. For many, this is, in some sense, a less physically relevant space. I don't agree with that. It's six one way, half dozen the other. It's certainly a more symmetric space-time for us to analyze scattering amplitudes. So we'll focus on this. I'll be constructing asymptotic particle states out of a vacuum state, which is the natural vacuum in this space, which is the Hartle-Hawking or Euclidean state. It satisfies a number of nice properties. It's the maximally symmetric state. It's a Hadamard state in the free theory, reduces to the Minkowski vacuum. It's everything you want in a vacuum state. So we should begin by discussing just what exactly an S matrix is. The simplest way to understand an S matrix is really as a scattering matrix, a matrix of amplitudes between asymptotic particle states. Particles can be labeled by direct products of the unitary reducible representations of your underlying symmetry group. In Minkowski space, this is the familiar first notion of an S matrix, and it describes what are typically called asymptotically free particles, particles that are largely separated and non-interacting at infinity. And of course, in Minkowski space, we can connect this to actual scattering amplitudes. Another way of understanding the S matrix is a bit more abstract, and it's simply as a unitary map between equivalent representations of your Hilbert space. This is ultimately the better way to understand the De Sitter S matrix. In fact, people involved in, say, the amplitude program might even consider an S matrix as just a scalar invariant of your theory defined to satisfy a certain number of prescribed symmetries. A very old set of technology, which we'll use in this talk, is to relate scattering amplitudes to the mass poles or regipoles in a complex momentum plane. The reason I prefer this definition of an S matrix to that of scattering amplitudes for our talk is twofold. The first is that one cannot actually perform scattering experiments in global De Sitter and observe both the initial and final state. The second reason, though, is that the asymptotic states in global De Sitter are not free particles. They have a particle interpretation, but not free particles. So just to run through a technical definition of what asymptotic particle states are, let us consider, for simplicity, a massive field. An asymptotic particle state is a normalizable state labeled by some definite particle content, some set of labels for the De Sitter UIRs that transforms as a tensor product under the De Sitter group. This is precisely how a free field transforms, a free particle state transforms, but it doesn't necessarily mean the particle state is free. Because we desire a flat space limit, we have to choose this Hartle-Hawking vacuum. My point, however, is that this is our definition of asymptotic particle states, not states that look free, simply some state in the theory that transforms in a certain way. Okay. So asymptotic particle states can be constructed in the standard way you learned when you first learned quantum field theory, using an LSE prescription under the assumption that you choose a sufficiently careful wave packet. For free fields, a wave packet is just some solution to the linearized equations of motion. It just carries the quantum numbers you want in your desired particle. For interacting theories, we have to be a bit more careful. And this is where I don't want to go into too many technical details. But as I'll describe in the next section, the goal of this wave packet is to select the mass pole part of the quantum field. The reason we need to take care in defining asymptotic particle defining wave packets in De Sitter space is that if we're not careful, we'll get power law infrared divergences, very unphysical infrared divergences. And this is simply due to sort of a naive attempt to construct asymptotic particle states. Sorry, that I can split.
Well, you can the whole manifold in space flight across timeline.
I can split my manifold into. That I can foliate my space time?
I mean,
I'm a little confused. I can definitely choose a coordinate chart and have a time definition and have a notion of time.
You're not going to talk about anything more complicated than just a space here, right?
Right.
So, you know, say maybe you go back, hold on, if your mind is going to say your weapon, then what is it?
Sorry.
Once you go back a couple of slides and draw the Penrose diagram.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So, eta is not the frequently used cosmologist conformal time coordinate. It's a it's just related to the global time coordinate. I don't know if this will help the discussion. It's a global time coordinate, and I've just rescaled it so that I don't have to write e to the t everywhere. Eta takes up less space on the slides. That's all. They are Cauchy surfaces. Yep, yep. This is global de Sitter. It's a cylinder. It's a hyperboloid in an embedding space. And these are compact Cauchy surfaces, so they have a topology of a sphere. De Sitter is globally hyperbolic. Any chart, any of your favorite chart from a textbook is globally hyperbolic in its own right. So, no, the whole space is globally hyperbolic. There are no boundaries. There's no data one would need to prescribe to add global hyperbolicity.
Wow. That doesn't mean it's not global hyperbolic.
Yeah, yeah. So any of the, in many ways, quantum field theory and the global chart is the sort of on the most solid footing because you can. There are so many more formal results when you have compact Cauchy surfaces. So if you like, I'm really cheating and using the simplest version of de Sitter to quantize it.
There are no horizons in the global.
Depends what you mean by a horizon. I mean, any observer in any chart will have a, sure. His cosmological horizon. But there's no, my constant time slices are spheres. There is no horizon in the past or future. Yeah. Okay.
So what do you mean by linearized solutions? Do you mean solutions to linearized equations?
Yes, I do. Yeah. Yeah. Right, I'm trying to hide from you technical details that will become a bit clear in the next section. Okay. Right, so I mentioned that asymptotic particle states are not free, and this set of cartoons is meant to depict that. They depict diagrams that one would not consider when computing S matrix amplitudes in Minkowski space. And the point is that these, in fact, do give non-vanishing contributions to scattering amplitudes in De Sitter space. This is not at all surprising. You're doing quantum field theory in a time-dependent background. So you don't have conservation of energy, and three particle states can come out of the vacuum. So what this picture is supposed to represent is the statement that in perturbation theory, your, say, final two particle state and final one particle state can have non-zero overlap. This is a result of the fact that working in De Sitter space, where we never turn off the expansion, particles are always being created. And the particle concept simply isn't that useful. So how we deal with this in perturbation theory is simply by re-orthonormalizing our particle bases at each order of perturbation. This is a technical statement. It's just meant to for you to not think that I have properly, I don't want you to think that I haven't properly accounted for the fact that there's no conservation of energy. Okay. Right, so modulo some details, which some of which I'll go into later and some I will entirely skip. The statement is that in perturbation theory, one can construct an S matrix with the following properties. Because I use the Hardwell-Hawking vacuum as both my initial state vacuum and my final state vacuum, The vacuum to vacuum amplitude is simply one by construction. There are no vacuum bubbles. There's no renormalization of the vacuum normalization. This means that this type of S matrix is not useful for studying things like vacuum decay. Okay, it's simply not a part of this formalism. The remaining properties are standard properties from flat space. So the S matrix is covariant under the de Sitter group, behaves appropriately under CPT, is invariant under perturbative field redefinitions, and is unitary. And unitarity in the S matrix is usually encoded in the optical theorem, which can be written in terms of the transition matrix in this form. And we'll see that formula again later. Okay, so now I'd like to explain a little bit more about what S matrix amplitudes actually capture, what the gauge invariant part is. And so I want to relate S matrix amplitudes to local correlation functions, okay, and basically show you what part of the local correlation functions are captured by these in the amplitudes. So the basic upshot is that the S matrix captures the mass pole part, as I think I've mentioned before, of correlation functions defined in a suitable complex mass plane. So for simplicity in this section, we'll just consider massive scalar fields. They're one particle states form unitary reducible representations of the de Sitter group. So let me define something that I'll call the weight sigma, which is related to the conformal weight in a DSC of T type language. And consider two types of scalar fields. Heavy fields typically belong to the so-called principal series. And they have a value of sigma, which I've drawn in the complex sigma plane as a green line. This green line has some negative real part, which corresponds to minus d minus 1 over 2, and then some imaginary part, which goes parallel to the imaginary axis. These are heavy fields in de Sitter space. And the key thing you need to notice is that they have a relatively negative real part for the value of sigma. Complementary series fields are light fields. They have a value of sigma that runs along the negative real axis and can be arbitrarily small if you choose arbitrarily light fields. Also shown in this picture is this shaded region to the left of the green axis. These are reducible unitary representations. So any value of sigma on that side could be written as an integral over the principal series. This is the complex mass plane that I'll be using over the next couple slides. So as the mass increases, one moves, the two roots of this equation for m squared move towards this axis that I labeled gamma p, and then along it. These weights simply provide the leading exponential decay of linearized solutions to the equations of motion. So if these are Klein-Gordon modes, defined by some mass parameter, some weight sigma, and some angular momentum, then the behavior at large eta has the two falloffs corresponding to the two roots of m squared. So to see how poles and the S matrix is related to poles, I'm going to use first for the two-point function the Callan-Lehmann representation of the two-point function. So W here is a free two-point function corresponding to a mass parameter mu. And in an interacting theory, one can write the full two-point function in the form of the first equality. So for example, if we're a free theory in the principal series, one can write the two-point function where the Lehmann-Callan weight has just two mass poles. It's fairly simple. For a complementary series, these are just lighter fields. You would have two mass poles on the real axis corresponding to the region where the complementary series values of sigma are. And as you compute in perturbation theory, your Lehmann-Callan weight will acquire a whole forest of poles that will lie either along the unitary representations or in the unitary reducible representations off to the left. Okay, and the claim is basically that what the S matrix computes are certain contour integrals in this plane, and it picks up the residues of these poles. Does this make sense?
I'm a bit confused about this. Different poles are usually different mass of space, right?
They are, precisely, yeah. Yeah, so in the, right, so the point was in the free theory, you have two poles corresponding to a certain one particle states. And then in perturbation theory, you acquire other poles. And these poles have interpretation as bound states. So these are isolated point places of support on sort of different mass shells in your theory.
Usually, I mean, to get bound, you don't get bound states when you calculate as many systems. I mean, you have to include bound states as extra states.
Right, I'm not, so to get bound states in your asymptotic states, you need to be, you need to sort of know they're there and think, and be much more careful. You would need to use Hagg rule, Hagg rule S matrix type construction. The point is, nevertheless, in the, any sort of singularities in the complex plane have various interpretations, as you're saying. And I'm simply saying that these are, you can interpret these other poles as bound states or, if you like, resonances. At these other masses.
Okay, so that happens, can you like at one loop get extra poles?
Absolutely, yeah, at one loop you get a whole sort of forest of poles coming from your the self-energy. Very much an analogy with in flat space. In flat space you get branch cuts because you don't have an infrared cutoff like we have here. But,
so in
the flat space limit what would happen is these sort of forests of poles come together and form a branch point. And you get branch cuts, and then you can do your familiar sort of Kutkowski type analysis. Yeah.
So can you remind me what W is?
W is the free two-point function. Yeah, I'm sorry if that wasn't defined. And this is a notion of the Lehmann Kalin representation.
And pi is.
It's just a function I've defined, but it does have the interpretation as the self energy. It's the correction to the free Lehmann Kalin.
So it's something you need to calculate.
Yes. Yeah. You calculate it in perturbation theory. Yeah. And this is just a cartoon showing possible.
And x1 and x2, they are also not the same times, right? They can be different times.
That's right. Yeah. Right, so for the two-point function, there's this nice representation, the Lehmann-Kalin representation, which allows you to very cleanly see how one particle states are related to singularities in a complex mass plane. For higher correlation functions, this process is a bit more involved. For higher correlation functions, a useful way of representing the correlation functions is in terms of Mellon-Barnes integrals. So a Mellon-Barnes integral is a integral in the complex plane. So for example, for this three-point function, there are three contour integrals over the variables mu, ij, labeled there. And then there are three arguments corresponding to the three invariant distances between three points. And there's some integral kernel. And that kernel has again, a forest of poles. And these poles control everything about the correlation function. In particular, the locations of these poles dictate how you can deform these contour integrals, and by deforming these contour integrals, you are able to obtain various asymptotic expansions of the three-point function. Okay. So for higher endpoint correlation functions, there is an analog of this expression that just gets more and more baroque. The key point that I wish to make is that scattering amplitudes can be related to certain residues of poles in this kernel evaluated at the weights. And I don't want to go through sort of technical details of that.
Pronormalizations are hidden in this phi and in this case in K, right?
What is hidden in there?
Renormalization.
Absolutely, yeah. This quantity K is just like the self-energy pi. It's something that needs to be computed at each order. Yeah. And I'm just trying to use sort of collective wisdom from studying through the years to explain how these things enter into scattering amplitudes. The fact that I'm working in the maximally symmetric state simply dictates this form, but doesn't dictate where the poles of K are. That's a theory-dependent aspect. Okay, so enough about that. Let's do a quick example. So let's consider a theory of three massive operators. Phi 1, phi 2, and 3, each with different mass, and we'll couple them with a cubic interaction and compute their tree-level amplitude. Okay. despite everything I just said about scattering amplitudes being related to residues of the poles, that's a bit of a formal statement. For low orders in perturbation theory, I wouldn't actually recommend obtaining these Mellon-Barnes representations and then relating them to the amplitudes. One can simply use a more straightforward LSE-type analysis and compute integrals over solutions to the equations of motion. So for instance, this amplitude ends up being precisely what you would have guessed from flat space. It's just an integral over three solutions to the linearized equations of motion. The key thing I want you to take away from this amplitude is that it's in fact non-vanishing in general, except for possibly discrete configurations. And this is very different from in flat space. In flat space, conservation of energy typically prevents tree-level decays. In order to have a tree-level decay of this type in Minkowski space, you would need to couple a heavy field to two very light fields, two fields whose mass squared, the sum of their mass squared is less than the mass squared of the father particle. In de Sitter space, we don't have a conservation of energy, and so there is no obstruction to this amplitude being non-zero. So in particular, here I've made a plot of this tree-level amplitude as a function of the father mass, m1 squared. The daughter particles have m squared values of 2 and 1.25. So naively, you would expect this amplitude to peak at 3.25. But in fact, it does not. It peaks around 3.5. And the question is, why is that? Because the answer is that we're not in flat space, and so the naive sort of addition of mass does not quite hold. What actually occurs is that the amplitude is peaked at a value of sigma 1 equal to sigma 2 plus sigma 3, and this, in fact, doesn't correspond to a real mass squared. So
I should consider that temperature a real particle, right? I'm not thinking
you should think, sorry?
You don't really have a local vertex, right? Then you would have, say, okay, locally it's flat space and have the same rules as usual.
Well,
it's effectively integrated over.
The interaction is local, but the amplitudes are constructed by integrating over Cauchy surfaces at scribe plus and scribe minus. So if you like, they're picking up the very slight probability of particle decay over huge superhorizon scales.
Yeah.
That's why this answer is so different.
Yeah,
and the amplitude, I should say the coefficient in front of the amplitude is e to the minus some function over L, where L is the de Sitter radius. So this is sort of non-perturbative in the de Sitter radius. Okay. So the reason this amplitude is not peaked at the naive value is because the amplitude is peaked at the sum of sigma 2 and sigma 3. So if I plot sigma 2 and sigma 3 as the green and blue dot, adding them, you get some singularity in the three particle in the three-point function, basically, that's away from the line of positive mass squared. And so this amplitude is peaked when we approach the positive mass squared that's sort of closest to the purple dot. Does that make sense? Yeah? Okay. So this is the sense in which these poles in the complex plane are useful, because they sort of tell you they tell you the structure of the amplitude.
Confusion here. So usually in the S matrix flat space, and there is these integrals of finite, physical vibrating bodies and particles can track for a limited amount of time. And because they're coming from infinity, they track for a while and then it'll go away.
Right.
So that's why they don't travel for finite. Like in the center, they don't go away because they cannot travel farther than the horizon. So I wonder they should keep tracking each other all the way to infinity and to the asymptotic future, which makes me wonder whether these integrals are finite or infinite.
So my claim is they are finite, but one needs to be careful in constructing them. This was part of the technical detail.
I thought that your initial and final states are finite eta's, right?
No, we're taking eta to infinity.
You are taking eta.
Absolutely. Yeah, you must take it to infinity in order to have an object that transforms appropriately under the de Sitter group. We're not doing finite time amplitudes. These are taken to infinity. They are in fact finite, and this is something that many people were confused by. But your intuition is absolutely correct. I made the statement that the asymptotic particle states are not free. The fact that you get this non-zero transition amplitude is another indication of this. As you move, if you construct particle states at some finite time, as you push them to the future, you get contributions from things other than the two-point functions. You get three-point functions and four-point functions as you move and that's different from the cosmic space. So yeah, this is the sense the asymptotic particle states are interacting still. Yeah. Okay, but this presents us with a slight problem. The fact that this is quite general and that particle states can decay at tree level. So in Minkowski space, particles that can decay at tree level are typically viewed as unstable. This can be seen from the optical theorem. If you have a tree level decay, then that means that at one loop, you receive a contribution to what I have written here as the real part of the scattering matrix element or the imaginary part of the transition amplitude. And this means that you acquire a complex mass. Acquiring a complex mass exponentially damps your correlation functions, and that means that after you've done a 1 pi resummation, these unstable particle states simply don't enter into the asymptotic states. The decay.
Sorry, can I ask a question about the former plot?
Yes, yeah.
So here you have a certain behavior as a function of n1 squared. That's
correct, yeah.
And so how does it behave in the limit when n1 squared goes to infinity?
It goes down to zero.
How precisely do you know?
Yeah, I'm sorry that. Oh, how precisely? It decays exponentially.
Exponentially?
Absolutely, yeah.
As it should. Right?
As it should, yeah.
There's been some confusion about this, hasn't
there? There has been confusion. So this amplitude agrees.
Quite a few incorrect papers, including from this institute, this time.
Oh, okay. There's been a lot of confusion about this, and I was trying not to focus on this. I mean, one could give an entire talk about how just being able to compute S matrix amplitudes resolves a lot of controversy about the stability of quantum field theories in the system.
No, but I
didn't want to go
into
that.
My intuition tells me that WKB analysis should be the correct answer in the limit. And
yes.
That indeed is that particle production should be suppressed exponentially.
Absolutely.
With a mass. And that's exactly what you now told me. And
yes.
There's been some opposite statements in literature as far as I'm.
There's contradictions at every turn.
Okay, but I'm glad that you actually confirmed my intuition.
Yes, yeah. These amplitudes are obviously constrained by flat space results. You have to, as you say, you should agree with the WKB approximation at large momentum or at large mass. Okay, so my claim is though that we run the risk of having a rather boring punchline to the talk because if all particles decay at tree level, then it might seem that after one loop, you have no asymptotic particle states. The flat space intuition would be that particles that decay so easily are just unstable and don't belong in your asymptotic states. So the question is, does this Minkowski space intuition hold true in De Sitter space? So what we need to understand is if tree level decay actually gives a complex mass. In De Sitter space. And to do this, we can relate the one-to-one scattering amplitude to the self-energy. And we wish to examine how the mass poles shift in the self-energy in a language that's hopefully familiar from flat space. So this minus 2 times the real part of the amplitude is the object that the optical theorem says must be greater than 0 because we have a tree-level decay. And it's a simple computation to relate this to the poles of the self-energy. When you do this computation, there's a term that diverges logarithmically as you take the initial and final states to infinity. And then there's also some finite part. This divergence is the same divergence you encounter in Minkowski space, though typically you don't work in position space to hear it phrased in this language. That's fine. This is canceled. It's a feature of perturbation theory. It's not anything to worry about. The point, however, is that the optical theorem requires that the coefficient of this logarithmically divergent term be greater than 0. So basically, it requires this combination of the self-energy, which is evaluated. It's the difference of the self-energy evaluated at its two mass poles with some overall denominator this quantity has to be less than or equal to zero in order for the S matrix to be unitary. Okay. So let's examine how the mass poles shift. We can define the mass poles to be sigma plus and sigma minus. In the free theory, delta plus and delta minus. In the free theory, they're just given by this value sigma and its conjugate, which I drew all these pictures of before. How these quantities shift, say at order g squared in our example theory, is given by these equations. That's a very simple computation. The actual value of sigma plus of pi evaluated on shell is a function of your renormalization condition. You can decide to keep the mass fixed, or you can let it run, basically. So that's depends on your renormalization scheme. However, the sum of delta plus and delta minus ends up being renormalization independent. So the claim is that the sum of the locations of the two mass poles is a renormalization independent quantity, and the optical theorem then requires that this is less than minus d minus 1. Okay, it's minus d minus 1 in the free theory, and unitarity requires that it become less than minus d minus 1 once interactions are incorporated. So I've just done some algebra to try and state that which direction the poles shift in perturbation theory as constrained by unitarity. So let's see what the consequences are for various types of fields. This is the result that I argued in the previous slide. And so now let's go through how this affects heavy fields and light fields, bearing in mind that all fields decay at tree level. So for principal series fields, these are heavy fields. Their free mass poles lie right along this axis, which has a real part minus d minus 1 over 2. Requiring that the sum of the locations of the mass poles be less than minus d minus 1 over 2 means that the poles shift to the left. This means that they shift away from the values of sigma which correspond to real masses. These do, in fact, acquire a complex mass. Their mass poles shift to the region where they would be described as reducible unitary representations. All of this, everything I've just said, are different ways of stating that these particles become unstable. They don't belong as members of asymptotic particle states. This is the intuition we got from flat space. This turns out to be true for sufficiently heavy fields. For extremely light fields that are in the complementary series, these are fields with masses of order the inverse de Sitter length. The requirement that their two mass poles need to sum to larger than d minus 1 over 2 is not as restrictive. This pole can simply be shifted further to the left. As a result, they continue to have a pole lying along the line of positive mass squared. And so they have a real renormalized positive mass, and everything is fine. These are stable asymptotic particle states. So the claim is that due to the lack of conservation of energy in global de Sitter space, any field that's not extremely light is unstable at one loop and doesn't belong in your asymptotic particle states. Therefore, if you consider a theory with only heavy fields, you really don't have an S matrix. You have a theory of resonances. Yes? Yeah. So the separation between these two types of fields is, as I said, whether or not their mass is of order the de Sitter length. So
I mean, while technically they're unstable, I mean, if you have a very tiny cosmological constant, presumably they're so close to stability, maybe they really should be included, right?
Yeah. I mean, you'd have to if you wanted to plug into Day's effective de Sitter radius, then I mean, certainly every observed particle belongs in this category. However, this instability only occurs in the global de Sitter S matrix, certainly not in the static patch S matrix, which would be the one that we would observe ourselves. Yeah.
So that means basically they're all effectively stable.
They're all effectively stable. This has no direct relevance to observation. Yeah. As I said before, the sort of the three particle, the 1 to 2 amplitudes that govern this effect are exponentially suppressed in the de Sitter radius. So you will not see this in any order in perturbation theory in inverse powers of the de Sitter radius. Yeah. This is an effect that comes from integrating those corners of de Sitter space, not the part that comes from the static patch.
Just a silly question. said that the normalized deltas themselves are scheme dependent.
The sum is scheme dependent.
The sum is scheme independent.
Independent.
The individual deltas are
absolutely
scheme dependent. So what do you mean exactly when you say that the like the norm the complementary series fields?
Good. Yeah. So I claim that the sum of these two locations is scheme independent, and so starting here on the top graph. The sum requires that their real parts move to the left.
But for the complementary series fields,
right.
There's like some set of...
There's a choice. You have a choice. What the constraint that their sum has to become less than d minus 1 means they have to move apart. You do, however, have the choice, using sort of standard mass and field of normalization counterterms, to move them where you like on the real axis.
Okay.
So this particular plot was made with the choice of trying to keep this first pole located where it is. So if you like, it's an on-shell normalization scheme. Yeah, but certainly we can move these like this.
Or even.
No, we cannot do that. Right, these poles have to either lie on the real axis or else they have to come in pairs mirrored on either side. And that's a consequence of the fact of locality that I don't, it's a really simple argument, but I don't want to go into it. Yeah.
Okay.
That's why they have these certain. If you like, these poles govern the large distance behavior of the two-point function, and these are real fields. So you can't have poles that lie off on the imaginary plane, otherwise they would sort of pick up an imaginary part at space-like separations. But I could go into that in detail elsewhere.
Where does a massless field lie on the...
Good question. It depends on what kind of massless field. Massless scalars and certain higher spin fields such as the graviton, would have a bare mass here. Its two sort of conjugate poles would lie right here. For certain spins, such as spin one fields, massless fields still effectively have a mass and live here. But the answer is they always lie in this complementary series where I claim particles are stable.
Yeah, I'm just kind of confused because
mm-hmm.
I asked you where they were and you pointed, but on the other hand, you told me I could move them where, you know, the pair of poles wherever I want. So isn't there a tension there?
Well, I gave you the values of the free mass, which are certainly not subject to renormalization schemes. Those are fixed. Those are governed by their linearized equations of motion. You can always renormal. So for massive fields, you can move your poles because you're allowed to have mass counterterms. For massless fields, if you want to consider a massless scalar, then we can add a mass counterterm. If you want to consider, say, a gauge field, you don't have a separate mass renormalization term. You just have a field renormalization term. Those don't allow you to shift the poles. They only allow you to shift the value of the residues.
Are you going to show us the results for the massless scale?
I'm going to talk a bit about gravitons next, though it's fairly preliminary. And yeah. OK, so I wanted to go over a number of sort of ways to move forward from this sort of relatively basic discussion about the S matrix for scalar fields. Right, so the hope of this, the long-term hope of this is to actually have a scattering matrix for gravitons in Sitter space. And this brings up a host of issues which I personally actually think are important issues even though many people ignore them. There is an entire question about whether or not quantum gravity perturbative Einstein-Hilbert gravity even makes sense in De Sitter space, in particular in global De Sitter space. And there, part of the confusion and the problem with this whole area of study is the fact that the computations that seem necessary to approach this question are extremely difficult. And that means that relatively few people have actually endeavored to make careful arguments one way or the other, and the literature is filled with not careful arguments. But the hope that the S matrix would give us something to compute, some gauge invariant observable with which to address this question. However, the general scheme that I gave for constructing an S matrix relied on a De Sitter invariant vacuum state. And the existence of this state in gravity is debated. In particular, there are a number of works by Thomas and Woodard, which have basically claimed that this state either doesn't exist in the linearized theory or is an artifact of linearized gravity, and certainly doesn't exist once interactions are incorporated. So unfortunately, this issue needs to be addressed in order to construct an S matrix as I've described it. Okay, so since much of the debate about whether or not there is a de Sitter invariant state for gravitons lives in the space of linearized gravity, we might as well use the best technology we have to approach this question. So at the risk of putting everyone to sleep immediately, the best way to answer the question of whether or not there exists a state in a linearized theory is to use algebraic quantum field theory. It's just the tightest structure one has. It makes very clear what a state is and what the appropriate questions are. So this has already been sketched out by a number of authors, namely Chris Fuster and one of his students. However, the takeaway here is if you use an algebraic approach to linearize gravity in De Sitter space, it's very clear and very easy to construct a De Sitter invariant state. Okay, and in particular, the De Sitter invariant state exists on any cosmological chart because the algebraic approach doesn't care which chart you use. Right, some of these are technical details that sort of engage the literature and aren't terribly important. I simply wanted to state this is a necessary first step before one can construct scattering amplitudes. One needs to establish that there does in fact exist a vacuum state. And I can discuss that more with people who are interested.
Is the claim that there is or is not?
The claim is that there is. It's not necessarily a new claim. In this context, Atsushi Higuchi proved that the state existed a long time ago. The kerfluffle in the literature is not whether the state exists in the linearized theory, it's whether or not there exist De Sitter invariant Green's functions, which is a rather technical point. However, in perturbation theory, one would like to preserve this De Sitter invariance. And so this is actually a sort of a necessary thing to prove. So that's the main sort of thing that needed to be proved. Okay. Yeah.
Isn't it true that even for a massless scalar field, there's no state that's invariant under the whole consider field?
Yes, it's true for a massless scalar field. It is not true for a massless spin 2 field. That's the thing. Yeah.
So you're saying there is a difference between the graviton and the scale?
There is, certainly. And the reason for this confusion in the literature is that in a lot of gauges, you end up writing down the graviton. You end up declaring that the graviton two-point function satisfies a massless scalar wave equation. But of course, the graviton is a gauge field. So the answer of whether or not a state in a gauge theory is invariant under some symmetry, say De Sitter symmetry, comes from looking at the gauge invariant observables. In linearized gravity, you have local observables, so you can analyze this question.
In linearized gravity, if you do scalar vector tensor decomposition that all cosmologists do, then the trace transverse part is which the graviton is in the gauge environment. So, and that one does obey the same equation as scalar vector. This is a very simple and straightforward argument that holds for the scalar field should hold for the graviton.
Right. So the claim, So my claim is that that is not in fact true, and I can go. I'm happy to go into the details, but the point is the transverse. To be slightly technical, the transverse traceless sector of the graviton, which is a De Sitter invariant notion, has a well-defined De Sitter invariant expression. It's when you move to transverse traceless synchronous gauge that you have to that you encounter this problem with a massless scalar. But we I'm happy to go into this in elsewhere. Okay, so returning to scalar theories, there's something that I think holds some interest. When examining the S matrix for generic theories of scalar fields, there were certain discrete configurations of fields for which the S matrix suffered additional infrared divergences. And we didn't have a good explanation for this at the time. These are scalar theories in which you combine the operators such that the sum of their weights adds up to minus d minus 1 minus 2n, where 2n is some integer. So these are very sort of special configurations in which the correlation functions of these theories have additional logarithmic divergences near the boundary. And as a result, the S matrix was not well defined. Similar divergences occur for the same theories in anti-de-Sitter space. If you combine these interactions with various specially tuned higher derivative interactions, these infrared divergences cancel. And these special combinations of interactions actually occur in a physically relevant context, that of dimensionally reducing supergravity on ADS5 cross S5 to ADS5. In this story, in ADS, the bulk operators are dual to chimeric primaries, which are known to be protected from perturbative renormalization. This is a very interesting, it's a very lovely story in ADS CFT. And the simple point I want to make here is that the same set of bulk interactions yield sort of the theories in which these infrared divergences magically cancel. And it's interesting to ask what the de Sitter interpretation is of these theories. In particular, I haven't checked that these theories in de Sitter space are actually free of renormalization in loops, but it seems to be sort of functionally the same thing going on. And it would be nice to understand why this is. In particular, in ADS CFT, the sort of reason that these bulk theories are protected is usually explained as a subtle consequence of supersymmetry in the boundary theory. And it's interesting to ask if there's some version of that interpretation in de Sitter space. All right, finally, also on the subject of DS-CFT dualities, a very natural extension of this work would be to consider higher spin theories. So Vasiliev gravity in particular is a theory of higher spin fields that contains a spin 2 graviton. And this has been of great interest recently because there has a proposed microscopic DS-CFT duality in which the bulk theory is Vasiliev DS-CFT and the boundary theory is an SPN model. From the ADS version of this story, we know that the asymptotic behavior of Vasiliev fields are highly constrained by their higher spin symmetry. In fact, if you examine CFT with a higher spin symmetry, you find that the correlation functions are constrained to have a finite number of structures. This is due to Maldacena and collaborators. And the interpretation of this in DS, in de Sitter, would be that the scattering amplitudes should obtain a finite number of structures. It should essentially be given by the structures available at tree level. Rather than get your hands dirty with Vasiliev theory, the natural way to approach this problem would be to attempt to generalize the various no-go theorems that prevent higher spin fields in free theory. Things by Perotti and Weinberg and the Weinberg-Witten theorem. So I think that's a very natural and tractable a problem for the de Sitter S matrix in the future. Okay, so just to summarize, this talk has been about the de Sitter S matrix, which I believe is a useful tool for analyzing quantum field theories in de Sitter. It captures the gauge invariant and field redefinition aspects of the theory and elucidates the implications of bulk unitarity. There are a number of differences between the S matrix in de Sitter and Minkowski space, which we've gone over. The most important one for me is that the asymptotic states should not be interpreted as approximately free particle states. I tried to emphasize that a consequence of the unitarity of the S matrix, a consequence of the optical theorem, is that heavy fields are, in this setting, resonances and are not stable particles. Only light fields enter into asymptotic states. And then I mentioned a few sort of obvious future directions.
What's the status of the field that's right on the boundary of being heavy and light? There's got to be some threshold where...
Yeah, and it has, it's, right, so heavy fields have mass poles up on this plane, light fields over here,
yeah.
And you're asking right when we bring these together. There are additional logarithms. As you combine poles, you get sort of second order poles, and that makes sort of all sorts of subtleties.
Can they be treated?
They can be treated, but they need to be treated specially. So one would have to look at that threshold.
Should they be considered resonances, weaker resonances?
Unstable
asymptotics?
I don't think so. I mean, I think that they should, this is really, what one would need to disentangle the differences between, as I said, so the free theory would have sort of a double pole located at one point rather than two simple poles. But there shouldn't be, I expect that when treated properly, this is still just a free theory and everything is healthy. So I suspect you just have to dissect all of these additional logarithms, and there are no indications that anything special happens at that point.
Is this all straightforward for fermions? Or are any surprises that occur, or is there subtlety?
To my knowledge, there are no additional subtleties for fermions. In fact, actually, Louis LeBlond, who used to be here, was working on this story for fermions, and so he was the one that told me that all of these details work out, but I haven't looked into it.
This issue of the certain variables, so let's go back a little bit.
Yeah.
And massless particles. I mean, if you want to choose the your hypersurface
mm-hmm.
on which to take the limits,
mm-hmm.
go to infinity, that hypersurface already breaks the symmetry. I mean,
the process is not manifestly
disintegrated. So you would have to, as far as I can see, you would have to. In order to convince me that you indeed have a disinvariant result, we have to do it on a global or positively curved slice, and then on a flat slice, and also negative curved slice. And then take limits in all cases and show that they are finite.
Well,
maybe combining these results would give a solid argument that you might be able to find this.
So let me just comment on that. It's true that the way you actually, you know, perform S-matrix computations is not sort of manifestly very symmetric. It's not invariant under the de Sitter isometries. I choose particular slices to define my states, and then I take the limit. And the point is that we want to make sure that that is the same limit if I then chose a different global coordinate chart, took a boost, and then took the limit, right? This procedure is easy to show for massive fields. For the massless scalar, it would be extremely complicated. My claim with gravitons is that the reason this is plausible but has not been verified is because properly smeared gravitons can actually be recast as properly smeared Weyl tensor correlators, which decay much faster. Okay, so it's not that and that's really the key. So that argument can extend for gravitons. But that's something to discuss online. But I just wanted to comment that you're absolutely right. The actual sort of intermediate steps of constructing an S matrix is not at all covariant.
You're referring to this Richards representation for gravitons, right? Which includes the Weyl tensors, which are conformally invariant.
No, I'm not referring to that. But we should talk about this.
Could you say a bit more precisely so you were saying that using algebraic monofield theory you can show that it's a varying vacuum state?
Yes.
Exists.
Yes.
So in what sense is it a vacuum state?
Oh, I don't, sorry. Vacuum is something I use because other people like that word. I don't.
Perfect.
It's a state. It's a Hadamard state in the theory.
It's a Sitter invariant state.
It's a Sitter invariant Hadamard state in the theory. And the statement is that is not a new result. That result is from when I was a child. But the existence of Green's functions is more hotly contested.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I'm wondering what it has to do. I mean, forget about gravity for a second. The question I've been wondering about, and I'm curious to know whether you mean to say that there's a result on one side or another about this. If I have the Higgs field, there's sort of two states. It's two, two SU2 invariant, two SU2 plus U1 invariant states I can consider. One is the state where the field is everywhere perched up at the top of the potential, and that's an unstable state, not invariant.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's another state, which is the field is, I could consider the SU2 plus U1 non-invariant state where the field is homogeneous everywhere, but somewhere at the bottom, at some point at the bottom of the fixed potential.
Mm-hmm.
And I take a uniform superposition of such states over the sphere of
mm-hmm.
vacuum of the fixed potential. You know what I mean? I'm not sure that
yeah,
so that would be another SU2 cross U1 invariant state, just built by taking the superposition of all the different actual stable vacuum states in the Higgs field.
Yeah.
And so that would be an example of something that would be an S, you know, that you would say there, okay, I have an invariant state that is, you know, stable vacuum state, but nevertheless, physically relevant thing if you want is that if I try to perch the field at the top of the hill, that's unstable. No actual observer will observe the invariant state of the field being perched at the top of the hill in the symmetric moment.
Okay.
I kind of wonder about the same thing about specific.
Okay, I don't see the connection at all, but let me make
what
a few
comments. What I mean to say is, yeah.
It could. Yeah, what is, sorry, you're relating this to gravity?
Yes,
good.
What I mean to say is, if you have a vacuum that corresponds to an actual consider invariant space time, is that thing unstable? That thing sounds like the physically important question. Or I could always take, if it decays into some de Sitter non-invariant thing, I could always take a de Sitter invariant superposition of all those de Sitter non-invariant things, analogous to taking the superposition of all the different Higgs vacuum states until I got
Okay. So the question with analyzing these issues of instability in non-linear gravity, the question is always, what do you want to compute? What is the question you're trying to ask? The reason that much of the discussion is focused on Green's functions, whether or not this is a good idea, has been to say, well, I don't know what to compute, but I just simply want to see if it's possible for the state to be de Sitter invariant. And so then it becomes a question about these gauge-dependent objects, these gauge-dependent Green's functions. That may not be a wise approach. So the question is what to compute. One of the goals of this is to see if the S matrix is something to compute to analyze these sorts of questions. The statement in algebraic quantum field theory is definitely in linearized gravity, where there are clear observables and the theory is exactly solvable. So there it's unambiguous. But right, so you first have to say what is it you want, what is the thing you want to talk about before you can address stability. Yeah. Yeah.
What goes wrong if you pick alpha vacua instead of the
Alpha vacua aren't Hadamard states, so that's not a technical thing. It's a very important thing. You need Hadamard states if you want all of the observables that are all of your classic observables to have quantum analogs, in particular if you want the Weyl squared tensor evaluated at some point to be well-defined object, you need to consider Hadamard states. Hadamard distributions are certain distributions that multiply nicely together, if you like. And it's not even a matter of interactions. If you want to be able to define normally ordered operators in a general curve space, you need Hadamard fields. So these alpha vacua get far too much attention. They're sort of, my claim is that an alpha vacua in gravity would not have arbitrary polynomials of the Weyl tensor as a well-defined observable.
But the analysis that you showed us, you wouldn't be able to carry it through with non-Hadamard, but the Sitter invariant vacua.
No, you would not be able to incorporate interactions,
yeah.
The sort of scalar theory? No, you can't, non-Hadamard distributions don't multiply nicely together. Basically, every 10 years, someone starts to try and compute perturbation theory with the alpha states in de Sitter space, and then they reach this conclusion. I think it's, I'm not saying it's impossible, but there are no signs that it is possible. Yeah. Also, it wouldn't correspond to flat space to your flat space.
The Weyl would be usually know about causality, don't
they? Well, I don't know. I mean, if you set up manifestly causal perturbation theory, I don't know if that would be a problem. But they certainly don't look like the Minkowski space vacuum at short distances, so that makes them of less interest to me. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Ian will be with us until Thursday.
Thanks.
Yeah.